Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Attorney John Yoo was a 34-year-old new hire at the Justice Department when the planes hit the Twin Towers and Pentagon on September 11, 2001. But he was a new hire who had clerked for Clarence Thomas and whose instincts under attack lined up with those of Dick Cheney. Within weeks of 9/11, John Yoo was writing a series of secret memos making legal arguments for the most controversial elements of the war on terror, on detention and the Geneva Conventions, harsh interrogation or torture, surveillance, huge presidential powers. 5 years on, critics call him a war criminal and menace to the Constitution. John Yoo calls himself a patriot on a new battlefront. Up next on Point, the legal architect of the war on terror, John Yoo. Joining me in the studio is John Yoo, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice. His new book is titled War by Other Means, An Insider's Account of the War on Terror. John Yoo, welcome.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Take us back to that day, 9/11. Who was John Yoo sitting in that office at the Justice Department? You were 34 years old. What was your background?
I was a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, where I still teach. And for many years before I went to the Justice Department, I worked on foreign affairs and national security, war powers. I'd written several articles about powers of the government in wartime. I'd also been in government several times before. I'd been general counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee under Chairman Orrin Hatch, and I had served as a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and D.C. Circuit Judge Lawrence Silberman. So I had never worked in the executive branch. I worked in the other branches of government. I'd spent a lot of time sort of working and thinking about foreign affairs. To be fair, the administration itself at that time, if you go back and think about it, wasn't really one that was focused on national security and foreign affairs. It was spending a lot of its time on tax cuts, fetal, you know, stem cell research, and so on. But I was hired specifically, you know, to work on the docket in national security within the Justice Department.
Immigrant family, your parents from, I guess when you were very, very young, from South Korea?
Oh, sure, yeah. My family came to South Korea when I was very young. We settled in the Philadelphia area. I grew up in Philadelphia, went to school in Philadelphia, went to college here at Harvard in Boston. And
how would you describe your politics as you sat there on 9/11 before the planes hit the tower? You remember the Federalist Society. You clerked for Clarence Thomas. What's your self-definition?
I would probably say I was a Republican, certainly. I was a political appointee in the Bush administration.
But the Federalist Society is something that has deeper meaning than just being a Republican or Democrat. What is that?
Oh, the Federalist Society is a group of lawyers. It doesn't have, I think, any positions of its own. I mean, it's a, you know, some nonpartisan group. But I think it is, you know, populated by lawyers who are primarily conservative or libertarian. And they themselves fight often about, for example, the very topic about president's power in wartime. Some in the federal side think the president's gone too far. Some think president's okay. But it's really set up as a network of people. They often hold debates in major cities and in all the law schools. But I don't think it's much more than that. It sort of doesn't have defined lobbying positions or doesn't litigate. So it's more like I think of it as a sort of gigantic debating society, but one that's mostly populated by conservatives and libertarians.
What happened on that morning of 9/11 at the Justice Department and in the weeks that followed that led you to be author, co-author of these secret memos that turned out to be kind of the architecture, legal architecture of the war, highly controversial, of the war on terror? Take us from that morning forward. How did that unfold?
Well, I was in my office and I saw, you know, no one saw at that time the first plane hit, but we ran into a room with a television, saw the second plane hit the towers. Most of Washington was then evacuated, if you remember back then, leading to tremendous, you know, congestion and It took people hours and hours to get out of the city. A small group of us, however, who worked on national security and war issues stayed behind to work through some of the already initially some of the issues. The basic one being, and I think this is sort of the effort in the War by Other Means book, is the, sort of the guiding difference, I think, between people about the war on terrorism. Was it really a war, or are we still engaged in some kind of dangerous criminal law enforcement action?
When was it clear to you, John Yoo, that you were going to be helping write the legal defense or infrastructure, if you will, of the war on terror justifications here? How quickly? Was it that very same day, 9/11? Was it later? When did Vice President Cheney's office or the Justice Department come to you, Steve Addington in the Vice President's office? How did this unfold?
Well, I think from the very first day, because I think from the very first day, people in the government wanted to know legally whether we were in a state of war. And I think that's a big difference, whether we're in a state of war or we're, you know, approaching things as a criminal justice problem. But from the very initial day, we started thinking about these questions. Are we at war? If we're at war, what are the president's powers in wartime to respond to attack and to take measures to protect the country? For example, if we're at war, right, the president can pretty quickly put up combat air patrols over cities, deploy the military and so on to protect from another 9/11 attack. If you remember back then, we didn't know if that was just the first of several attacks in the coming days or whether it would turn out to be an isolated incident, as it has since turned out to be. So we started working on a lot of legislation, like the Patriot Act, which you talked about in the book, the authorization, went to Congress to get authorization to use force against anyone connected with the 9/11 attacks. So all that started, I'd say, right away.
You wrote the secret memos that ended up giving the legal backdrop to sweeping surveillance, to this unorthodox detention, to harsh interrogation. Many call it torture. I know you don't. To a kind of rejection of the necessarily universal application of Geneva Conventions here, very, very sweeping presidential powers. Was that natural to you? Did that flow out of your background? Were you already primed to do that? Or did you, on 9/11, say, to heck with everything I've learned, we need a whole new way here? Take us into your own thinking.
Well, thanks for your question. I try to explain a little bit of the book, and I've written an earlier book about the powers of the president in wartime that came out about a year ago. But I've been working on these issues for many years before. And I had the view before 9/11 that the president could use force abroad without congressional permission, and indeed in violation of congressional statutes. This is the question raised by the War Powers Resolution. And many people in the academy think the War Powers Resolution is constitutional and think that presidents have waged war unconstitutionally for many years abroad. President Clinton in Kosovo being the most recent example before 9/11.
So it's constitutional and unconstitutional?
I'm sorry, the statute, the War Powers Resolution is constitutional, and so therefore whenever the presidents, like President Clinton in Kosovo, were using force abroad without any permission from Congress, that was an unconstitutional war. I had written several articles before 9/11 arguing that the president, in fact, had this power, that Congress couldn't take it away by simple legislation, that if Congress wants to stop the president in national security and foreign affairs, they have to primarily cut off funding, use their powers over domestic legislation, and so on. So I had written a number of things before 9/11 talking about the expanded powers of the presidency in wartime. And I thought that was sort of historically the case, that if you look at our wars over history, presidents have always wielded much broader powers in wartime, and Congress has taken a secondary role because the president, I think, has the constitutional power, is also sort of best suited institution in our government.
But you know that at this point, while there are some who support you, there are many who are harshly critical, who describe what you did in those weeks and months as a kind of fundamental undermining of the American Constitution, writing a kind of secret emergency constitution. And the brickbats have been heavy and large. We invited Anthony Lewis, the former New York Times columnist on all things judicial, to come on. He said he would not come on with you, that he considers you a war criminal whose legal interpretations have led to hundreds of deaths, that you've justified torture. You're sitting here kind of right at the nexus of this national debate. 5 years on, any second thoughts?
No, I don't think so. I think the point of the book actually is to show that these are hard questions. No one denies these are easy questions. I think that there are good debates arguments on either side, but I think these were hard questions. Reasonable people faced with those difficult circumstances, I think, made reasonable decisions. So I think when someone like Anthony Lewis or other folks throw around the term war criminal,
I don't think they're I don't think they're throwing it around. I think that is they're considered in
I think they also think the president is a war criminal, and I think they think Vice President Cheney's a war criminal. I think they think Donald Rumsfeld's a war criminal. They probably think the former attorney general is a war criminal. I mean, they think there are a lot of people in the administration war criminals. I think they use the phrase in an overly expansive way and sort of exaggerated rhetoric. I think there are, again, I think there are reasonable arguments on both sides. But I also think that these are difficult circumstances for which the decision that this is war basically causes us to have to make. So take an example. I think, Mr. Lewis probably thinks that it's illegal for the United States to conduct what he would call assassinations abroad of al-Qaeda leaders, because I think people like him and others who use this phrase war criminal don't think we're really at war. You know, if we're not at war, it would be illegal. It would be a war crime for us to try to shoot, use predator drones with Hellfire missiles to try to kill leaders of al-Qaeda. You look at the 9/11 Commission report, that was certainly something, a consideration that held the Clinton administration back from using those kinds of methods. I think we're in war, and I think we're at war. We're allowed to try to target and kill members of the enemy no matter where they might be.
John, let me ask you just quickly, why were these memos secret? If this is so legal, if it's so constitutional, why secret? Why did they have to be pried out over so much time?
Well, two things. One is usually when you give legal advice to any client, it's usually in private, and then
But this is the president of the United States in a democracy. We're going to war together, in your view?
Well, take the Geneva Convention, for example, issue where we thought, the president, the White House, the Defense Department all asked, what's the status of al-Qaeda Taliban prisoners on the Geneva Conventions? Our view was they're not covered. Al-Qaeda's never signed the Geneva Conventions, and they show no desire to follow them. They don't fight in any regular armed way. We provide an opinion to the White House. They issue a document that's not as complete and thorough as our opinion, but they issue a document explaining ultimately why the president decides that they're not POWs under the Geneva Conventions, and that's usually the case. With some other memos, they obviously include or discuss things that would be harmful, I think, to our war effort if they were made public.
Such as?
For example, terrorism surveillance program. If the memos on that, which discuss perhaps how it was done and so on, were made public, then obviously al-Qaeda would gain insight into any advantage we were using against them to gain information on their communication. So obviously releasing that would be harmful to the very thing we're trying to achieve.
You accuse some critics of these policies of playing politics with them, but was there a political incentive to keep these things secret? Was there concern that the American public might not accept these measures, these interpretations of the Constitution?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I mean, that wasn't what we had in mind when we do them. We always, provide them confidentially to the people who have to make the decisions. And then years later, they're made public. They're published, in fact, in a series. But I don't think that's untypical about any other kind of foreign affairs or national security decision. We don't publish the proceedings and minutes of the National Security Council till more than 35 years later.
But here we are getting pretty fundamental at a pretty important time. It's well known at this point that the vice president, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, and others who saw the Nixon era unfold and crash, for a long time thought presidential power needed to be reasserted in this country in a very strong way. In some ways, you gave them the legal infrastructure to do that. You were 34 years old. Did you ever feel used by a bigger agenda than your own legal interpretation?
No, I didn't. I also tend to think that presidential power in the post-Nixon period had been weak. But I also think that in this area, in war, that is an area where you expect and we generally want the president and the executive branch to have broader powers. That it's just been the practice of history. Look at what President Lincoln had done in the Civil War or President Roosevelt in the years leading up to World War II. And they also exercised very strong executive power to try to protect the country in national security and foreign affairs matters. So I didn't think that this was some kind of ulterior agenda. I think these were people who, look, we suffered an attack on the country, on the American homeland for the first time since the War of 1812. And it was a pretty devastating attack. And it was against a kind of enemy we'd never seen before in our experience, right? A non-state actor, right? A terrorist organization. In fact, what they did is beyond the powers of many nation states in the world today. And I think what they try to do is reasonably try to think of the policies that would allow us to protect the country from another 9/11.
To do that, I left your book with this question. Whether you were asking Americans to hearken back to an original interpretation of the Constitution that would permit that power, or at other points in the book, you're very clear in saying we have to think in new ways. So are you, John, you embracing, in your view, the U.S. Constitution, or asking Americans to break away, to break free, to break beyond it in some way in this conflict?
That's a very good question. My argument actually is that the original vision of the Constitution is one that's very flexible in wartime and allows the president and Congress to shape their roles over time. The framers didn't intend there to be these very fixed, defined procedures the way we use today for passing statutes, for example, because they knew that war was unpredictable and dangerous. And so, you know, there are things in the Federalist Papers that talk about this and that the response by our country ought to be able to be flexible to come to grips with anything new and unforeseen. When I say that this is a new war, I'm talking about the kind of policies would shape within that constitutional structure. Constitutional structure allows us to shape flexible policies that really can confront the kind of new challenge that the war on terrorism brings. The problem is that we're sort of set into, you know, pre-9/11, I think still post-9/11, we're sort of set into this framework where we think of wars as between nations. And we're trying to think of wars between big nations with regular armies and so on. And we tended to think of terrorism as a criminal problem. Right? That's how we all handled terrorism before 9/11. And I think when I talk about we need to think about this in a new way in terms of the policies is we're facing a private organization essentially that can wage the level of violence that only nations can. And that's why I argue that we should think that that is war and the way we approach war has to change because the enemy has changed.
Of course, the question then that sits on the table and the whole country is just staring at it is, are the kind of measures that you're describing consistent with American liberty? A pretty important issue. Let's begin to turn to our listeners from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Brad is calling. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I'd like to challenge this notion that there's anything new about what Mr. Yu has crafted. There's nothing whatsoever new about unbridled executive authority. It's a very old and well-known beast, and we know where it goes to. We saw it in the not too distant past in Argentina and Chile, where there were disappearances of people, and the way those disappearances were engineered was that people were declared an enemy of the state through an act of paperwork, and once they were declared an enemy of the state, they could be just whisked away without anyone being notified, with no access to counsel, friend, family, and with no charges filed. And with no release date or no opportunity to speak to a judge or even hear the charges against them. And the exact same thing has been crafted by this gentleman for the American people, and it's only a matter of time before we see those disappearances. Now, he's a member of the Federalist Society, as are five Supreme Court justices,
yeah.
And Roberts, who's a member, sat there and smirked at Kennedy while Kennedy was prancing around looking for 20-year-old whiffs of apparent racism. And promised unitary executive for Bush, and Kennedy never followed up on that thread, but kept sniffing around for 20-year-old racism, which was just a pathetic put-up of opposition.
A unitary executive, an extremely powerful executive, and that's what we're talking about here. Brad, you raise it very clearly. John, you, what about it? Here's the fear. Mm-hmm. That the power you would hand the president in your interpretation of the Constitution, even at war, is so unlimited, so unbridled, that we have the makings of a despot, of a tyrant, right here in the heart of American democracy as soon as we pick up your secret memos. What do you say to that?
Well, first, I don't think there's any comparison between Argentina and Chile and what's happening in the United States today.
Easy to say, but how do you justify that?
Well, one distinction is, you know, those were measures taken by the governments against their own populations. They were not at war with any foreign enemy.
But the line between other populations and our own quickly becomes fuzzy here. We're not talking about picking up potentially green card holders. Those are legal residents of this country.
But we are in a war with a foreign enemy. I think they may recruit
Americans.
We have
that point. But where is the break on executive authority in John Yu's world? What is the assurance to the American people that the liberty the country is supposed to be about is defended as you or your executive assert that you're defending the country?
Well, first, there are the traditional rules which you follow in war, which are, for example, in wartime, you always pick up members of the enemy who are enemy combatants. They don't get lawyers. They don't get trials. That's a very criminal justice way of thinking about things. That is not the way things work in war. We captured millions of prisoners in World War II. Some hundreds of thousands of them were held in camps in the United States. They didn't have lawyers. They didn't get trials and
is
so
there any,
on.
Is there yeah. any restriction on presidential power in wartime, in your view, when the chips are down?
Look, there's the second, I would say the second check is Congress, right? Congress has ultimate power to cut funding off for all of these programs. They have the power to pass laws to try to challenge the president, to try to stop these programs. And this is, in fact, if you look at what's happened over the last 5 years, you know, just 2 weeks ago, Congress passed a military commission. I would argue that even before then, Congress had given its approval to many of the programs by passing an authorization to use force.
What if the president and the Congress are in the same party? They're sort of walking in lockstep. Mm-hmm. And for political reasons, they sign off, which may or may not line up with constitutionality. You don't want the courts to come into the middle of this. You're very opposed to legal intervention, including in the Hamdan case last summer. You say the courts were wrong to get involved here. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I think that in wartime, you know, that is the primary check, that the president and Congress check each other, and that it's unprecedented for the courts during hostilities to get involved and try to get involved with the management of terrorism or wartime policy at all. And I think what you saw 2 weeks ago was that the president and Congress in this military commission bill essentially overruled many aspects of what the court had done last summer and basically said, you know, get out, go back to a traditional position of deference and so on. The other thing I would say about this is, look at the past pattern of practice in the United States in war. I don't think anything that Bush has done here goes even remotely close to, say, what President Lincoln did in the Civil War. You want to talk about presidents who went, maybe expanded their powers beyond the Constitution. President Lincoln took money out of the Treasury, raised an army, and invaded the South without any authorization from Congress. He didn't even call Congress into session until after he'd done all those things.
And in 4 years, the war was over. Now we're headed into a fourth year here, and we're told the war could go on for a long, long time. People's standard of measure are very keen here because of that.
That's
John Yoo's with
point.
Us. His new book is War by Other Means. I want to get a second opinion in here. Joining us from New York is Joshua Dreitel. He's co-editor of The Torture Papers, The Legal Road to Abu Ghraib, published last year. The book's an analysis, a compendium of government memoranda, including opinions written by John Yoo. He was lead counsel for David Hicks, an Australian detained at Guantanamo Bay. Joshua Dreitel, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm still lead counsel for Mr. Hicks. We'll see what happens in the next round of military commissions.
Still and forward. You hear and know well John Yoo's view of the legal world post 9/11. We'll look at the details, but take us in sort of at the top level. How do you respond to it? What do you think of it?
It is nothing less than an attempt to dismantle the Constitution and the checks and balances that are the fundamental protections that citizens have in this country and have had since the beginning of this country, since the Constitution was enacted. And I want to dispel one notion right away, which is this notion that who disagrees with the government doesn't recognize that we are at war. I didn't need to look at 9/11 on television. It happened outside my window, and my apartment building was damaged by the collapse of the Trade Center, and I was in one of those ash clouds. So I don't need anyone telling me that this is a war. But what it is a war like every other war, where you play by the rules, where you do not invent extrajudicial measures to deal with it, and then say the courts, as Mr. Yoo has said in his book, that the court should step aside for the entirety of the war, which is a extraordinary statement and one that is really, as you said before, unbridled executive power. That's the ultimate goal here. And it's not one that was precipitated by this war. Mr. Yoo also acknowledges in his op-ed article in the New York Times from 2 weeks ago that this was something that was on the table before the war. This was something that was on the agenda for this administration well before 9/11. And so 9/11 was merely a pretext.
Mr. Dreitel, John Yoo says, look at past presidents and what they've done, Lincoln, FDR, Moore. He says, this isn't new. This has been done before, this broad interpretation of presidential power. That, for many Americans, that's an argument that makes them, yeah, I'm sure, scratch your heads and say, well, what do you say to that?
I'd say two things. One is that we're talking about a degree and a type of exercise of power that is unprecedented. For example, yes, Truman sent troops to Korea, but when he tried to do things in the United States, the Steele seizure case, he was blocked by the Supreme Court, and he did not defy the Supreme Court and say, no, I don't care what you say, which is what the government says now, we'll do whatever we want. And we did not revoke the Geneva Convention in any of those conflicts. Lincoln was checked by the courts. And also, I think the Civil War situation is an extraordinary one. It is one that you can't really compare a Civil War where you have essentially half of the country seceding from the Union. You can't and you have border states where there is martial law and questions like that. You can't compare that to this situation. It's apples and oranges, and it's also an attempt to essentially resuscitate something that we've learned from over the period of 200 years.
I want to turn back to John Yoo, but let me just ask you this before I do. You're saying he's dismantling the U.S. Constitution. John Yoo says he's embracing a core principle in it, but he's also asking America to change for a new challenge. There's been a lot of pushback. John Yoo himself is critical of the Bush administration. He says they haven't stood up and justified their actions sufficiently here. He's holding the torch, he says, trying to do that. Where do you see this argument, Joshua Dreitel? Is John Yoo's vision of America winning the day, or do you see it with Hamdan and the rest being pushed back? Where are we in this domestic battle?
I think that we are fortunately in one in which at least the courts have not abandoned their role. And John Yoo, he has said in his book and elsewhere that the presidency is inherently a weak institution under the Constitution and historically. So this is a dramatic expansion. This is not something that goes back to core values. This is an undermining of core values, an attempt to create essentially a monarchy or an autocracy run by the president. And in that sense, it's a complete departure from what we're used to, and it spells trouble because what it is, it's unaccountability, and it's unaccountability through secrecy, through unilateral exercise of power, all those things which historically we know from this country and every other country in the world through history, those spell trouble for liberty. Mm.
Right now, Pete's calling from Ellicott City, Maryland. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're all right. What do you see, Pete?
My problem isn't with the powers, which is to be expected if you are at war and you have the president and Congress in the same party. My problem is this war, by definition, could almost last indefinitely. I mean, if 20 people can cause 9/11, how would you define the end of the war?
Let us pick it straight up, John Yoo, first to you. Pete's ready to get on board, but when it's unlimited in time frame, he's getting some nervousness about that.
Yeah, Pete asks a very good question. I think that's the hardest question, legal question, in the war on terrorism is when is it over, right? Because I think most people, or a reasonable number of people, would say, look, we're willing to hand the power of war over to the government for a limited time. We don't want these sort of permanent, extraordinary powers. We don't want a permanent national security state. I would add, though, how we had a Cold War that went on for quite some time with often we're in hostilities, and that went on for 40-some years.
There were things that we didn't give up during that war, but what about now?
But I would say, look, this is a really difficult question, and it's hard to say when we win in sort of traditional metrics of how we think of it. We're not going to sign a peace treaty with al-Qaeda. We're not going to capture their foreign capital and take over their territory and occupy the country because they have no country. So I think it may take a long time. I do think that the war is over when we have sufficiently killed or captured the al-Qaeda leadership and their major leaders so they can't undertake serious attacks on the United States homeland anymore. I know that's
What if that's many years? What if it's decades? Do you see a corrosive threat? I mean, we're hearing
yes. mm-hmm.
a threat described right now, today, already in your first memos sure. to the American Constitution. But even you, if it goes on for decades, do you see a threat?
Look, there's no doubt that people should be concerned if we're in a state of war, but that doesn't mean because it's long, it could be a long war, that it shouldn't be considered war if we're constantly having to fight an enemy that can carry out attacks like 9/11. Other countries, we're in American history, we've been very fortunate to have short wars. World War II, World War I, our involvement doesn't last very long. But other countries have had to face longer-term conflicts. War, just by definition, isn't short. It can be long. We've just been fortunate not to have to fight them. But I would say, look, what we would do naturally is we have elections, a series of elections during these conflicts. We have President and Congress have to cooperate. And if we don't think that we should be exercising these kind of powers for too long, you can vote them out of office.
Josh Dratel, what about this issue of the time, the time value or the time implications? Does it matter to you? Our caller says, look, I'd give the president this authority if it was time limited, or do you see it as corrosive no matter how short or long the time?
Well, the caller was correct in terms of the problem with a never-ending war. It is a perfect vehicle for the type of usurpation of authority that this administration is pursuing, and it's Orwellian. It's the state of permanent war, and it also permanizes a state of secrecy. And the whole point of why the Bush administration has not been aggressive publicly in defending its position is because it is indefensible. All the secret memos on torture and all the secret memos on Guantanamo and the bases for putting people in Guantanamo outside the rule of law, once they were public, they were indefensible and rejected by the courts. The reason we haven't seen, I believe, the memos justifying the NSA program of surveillance is because it's indefensible. There's nothing proprietary or that will tell terrorists about how they're being overheard. What those memos will have is a legal basis, which is indefensible.
Lewis is calling from Boston. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Mr. Yu has spoken a lot about the historical context of Lincoln and FDR and expanded powers during wartime. And I would like to know what Mr. Yu thinks of the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and does he consider that an appropriate use of wartime power?
I think Lewis asks a very good question. You know, I personally don't think that was a good idea. I think the constitutional mistake that was made there was that the government presumed that race was a proxy for loyalty to the country. I don't think that that's similar to anything that's going on in the country now. The other thing I point out was
You've seen all the controversy about the treatment of Muslims, of Arabs. Wherever you stand on that, how can you say it's not an issue?
No, I'm not saying it's an issue. I'm just saying that the United States government today isn't interning people in the United States because of their race, assuming their race means that they're allied with al-Qaeda. There's certainly sensitive questions about how the Muslim community is treated in the United States during this period of war.
Would you favor racial profiling?
No, I don't think it's necessary. In fact, I think al-Qaeda, once we do something like that, they would move, as they have, to getting Americans. You know, Jose Padilla is a Hispanic male, right, who's born in the United States. He's not Arab. So I don't think that's necessary.
And even with your own Asian American background, it doesn't leave you sensitive to the possibility that these sweeping powers that you're justifying here might be turned around and used on, somebody could have been in your family a few years from now.
Look, I'm not denying that I'd be sensitive to it. I think people in the administration are sensitive to this concern, and I think we thought about it a lot when we were developing the policies in response to 9/11, and we didn't do, I don't think, anything like the Japanese-American internment. I also would add that it's, seems to me that we would, and I think we do, we would want to reach out to that community because that's the kind of community that can help us in the war on terrorism to try to infiltrate and stop al-Qaeda cells. So I don't think there's anything to be served by something that broad. I will also say, look, the Japanese-American internment was authorized by Congress and it was upheld by the Supreme Court back then. So you want to talk about the checks of government. If you want to say, oh, they're going to protect us, back in the World War II example, all supported that policy. But I don't think that's something we have to face now because we're not thinking about anything like that.
John, you're very mild-mannered in the way you describe these issues, people raising the fear of monarchy or despotism is sort of out of line. And yet, Americans, myself included, are taught kind of from birth that monarchy is exactly what we got away from, that it's the whole point here. So I guess I'd have to say I don't understand your equanimity about this issue. This is kind of a red line, a third rail in America's fundamental politics. Why are you so?
Because I don't think we're anywhere near it. I don't think we're anywhere near monarchy or an autocracy. We've had multiple elections during this war. A presidential election where all these issues were on the table in the presidential election and were debated. And the American people voted for whose policy they agreed with. We've had several congressional elections. I think this idea of monarchy is too strong. I think the better way to think about it is just should we have expanded presidential power?
What's
or
the
not?
Difference? I mean, you expand them too much, and there you are.
Well,
bring out the crown.
Well, you have an expanded presidential power, but we have checks and balances. We still have a Congress.
You say courts stay out of it.
But we still
have one check gone.
Yeah, but we still have a Congress that participates through oversight, through briefings, funding. So take a lot of the issues that were raised earlier. Oh, Guantanamo Bay. Military commissions, interrogations. Congress just passed a bill 2 weeks ago basically, as far as I can tell, ratifying most of the president's decisions in these areas. Throughout the last five-year period, Congress has been briefed and notified, and they've discussed these policies between the executive branch and the legislature. So I think it's just exaggeration to say, oh, we're heading into this era of unlimited presidential power, or we're heading this era of monarchy or autocracy. What we really have is you always have to have cooperation between the president and Congress, particularly in wartime, but we want to delegate more power to the presidency, more power to the president, because the president is the one who can best fight wars. You know, no one thinks a legislature can fight wars. The president has to fight
I want to bring one more voice in here from Cambridge, Massachusetts. David Barron joins us, constitutional lawyer, specializes in separation of powers, worked as an attorney in the same office of legal counsel at the Justice Department under the Clinton administration. He's working on a book on the history of presidential power as commander-in-chief. David Barron, thanks very much for being with us. What do you think of John Yoo's argument?
Well, I think John is not quite being straight in describing what his legal position has been. So he's saying a number of times that there's a check because Congress and the president can cooperate. But in one of his memos that I think he was involved in writing, but certainly his office was right after the September 11th attacks, they stated very plainly that Congress may not by statute, and this is the quote, place any limits on the president's determination as to any terrorist threat, the amount of military force to be used in response, or the method, timing, and nature of the response. These decisions, as he said, under our Constitution are for the president alone to make. And I think that's a really important distinction to make between whether the president should have some initial flexibility to take on a new circumstance when there's no existing legislative restrictions upon him. But the position that Professor Yu's taken and that the administration has taken is that even when there are statutes in place, they need not be followed. And that's why the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act restriction on warrantless wiretapping was disregarded. That's why the statute prohibiting the military and the CIA from engaging in torture was disregarded. And the consequence of disregarding the entire statutory framework that was existing pre-9/11 has actually been very bad for the U.S. interest abroad, as I think is evident now. But also it's been very questionable whether it's actually been efficacious. So actually, had they taken a different approach, try and work with what was going to be a very cooperative Congress, we might have been able to get structures in place that would have been legal and upheld by the courts rather than the situation which we're in now, which is, he mentions we just got ratified military commissions 5 years later, as if that's a success. Why is it successful to have gone through 5 years where there was no successful trial of anyone?
You know, if I may ask you, this phrase has come up a few times in this conversation. I just want to go straight at it. If John Yoo's positions are controversial but defensible, that's one thing. If they're indefensible, that's where the war criminal charges come in here. Is that out of line? How do you look at that? Is it possible to advise a government?
I think people who take positions saying that it's legal for U.S. personnel to engage in torture have to expect that they're going to be raising questions about whether they are authorizing war crimes. It's not my place to say whether anyone's committed crimes or anything like that. I'm hesitant to suggest that people who I believe or hope are acting in good faith meant to be doing that. But I think the larger thing, aside from the questions of that sort, which are really beyond my desire to get into directly, is what is the kind of constitutional order that they're trying to construct for the country? And to suggest that it's very much in line with what Washington and Lincoln and Roosevelt said is just historically inaccurate. I mean, Lincoln and Roosevelt both were quite clear that when Congress spoke and when statutes were in place, they were to be followed, and that the proper role for the president was to get the Congress to agree with him and pass statutes authorizing it. John keeps saying, well, he got 90% of what he wanted. What's the 10% he didn't get? The 10% he often doesn't get is the most odious aspects of his policy, which had the least protection for individual liberty. That 10% is not trivial, and it trivializes the nature of the constitutional order to suggest that it is.
Let me take a call from Beaufort, South Carolina. Nate is on the line. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. I just have a couple little comments. First, I think that there's a very significant change in our society over the years, and perhaps that change in our society to the point where we no longer can accept the behavior as a logical behavior that comes with wartime. The behavior of the terrorists is just so repugnant and beyond what most of us can understand in any way that the retaliatory behavior that our government and our president has taken in most cases
we can't understand it. We just know we don't have the stomach for what's necessary as a populace anymore.
So you're standing with John Yoo here, Nate, and saying it's the society that's drifted away from the stomach to go to war.
Absolutely. I'm also saying that as far as the legal aspect of it goes, like so much else that's at fault with our legal system today, the intent of the law is no longer what's being followed. It's now how the law could possibly be interpreted to suit someone's best interest.
Nate, thanks for your call. Josh Dreidel, a final thought here. Nate says all this pushback against John Yoo's view is just because the country doesn't have the stomach to do the necessary, the stomach for war.
The stomach to completely change the character of this country and make it what it's not. We can't. We go back to the Vietnam statement, the wonderful statement of destroying a village in order to save it. We do not need to destroy our country in order to save it. We lasted through the Nazis and the Japanese, which were far greater threats and far more powerful, controlled all of Asia and Europe, and yet we prevailed without abandoning our values. We can do it now, and that's really position. I think that if you read the memos, they're available on the web. I'm not pushing my book. You can read them on the web. Read what Mr. Yoo has written. Read about how they were interested, how the government was interested in absolving actors of war crimes even before this all started, and you'll see what the intent was in this plan.
Joshua Dreitel and David Barron at Harvard Law School, thanks to both of you for being with us in this hour. John Yoo, here we are, the national conversation laid right in front of you. Do you ever have second thoughts? I mean, the pushback is so hard. You've been, booed and all the rest, cursed out in public meetings. You seem quite unflappable about it. Do you have any second thoughts?
Look, when you're in the government and you're faced with these questions, look, no one goes into government to answer these questions. They're really, I think, difficult. What are the status of terrorists as POWs, the Geneva Conventions? Can you assassinate them? Interrogation, all the things you mentioned, these are not easy questions. And I think no matter what you decide to do, you're going to get a lot of criticism from one quarter or the other.
What about effectiveness? The New York Times today, mm-hmm. just as David Barron now says, look around the world, the U.S. has squandered its moral authority. And that is ending up to be a bigger problem in the war on terror than any of the details along the way. Does mm-hmm. it give you pause?
Well, I say, look. If you want to measure effectiveness, you could ask, have there been any successful terrorist attacks on the United States after 9/11? I don't think it's just luck or Al-Qaeda being inept, which they certainly are not, which has prevented the attacks. So the United States has taken very aggressive measures, to be sure. And, you can look at the discussions we had, some of which I described, and we said there were going to be negative implications, negative reactions in the world community and public opinion and so on. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of successes that those policies allowed us to stop numerous terrorist attacks and have allowed us to really degrade Al-Qaeda significantly from where it was on 9/11. So that's, I think, it's a trade-off. I'm not saying...
Do you think the time for American liberty as we've known it has come and gone?
No, I think look around the world around us today. I mean, have we really suffered serious civil liberties deprivations inside the country to the extent we had in previous wars? One of your callers mentioned the internment. Lewis mentioned the World War II internment. So the Japanese Americans, over 100,000 people. Look at Lincoln established military government in the country, military trials for civilians. I think civil liberties, given that we're in the middle of this kind of war, have not been dramatically affected within the United States.
And the war criminal charge, if there's a change in Congress, a change in the executive, do you ever expect to have to defend yourself in court against that?
I don't know. Part of the reason I was writing the book in the first place was to sort of explain why we made these choices and the decisions we made. And I'm happy to accept the implications of those decisions in the future.
You're a cool cat. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Tom. It was a pleasure.
John Yoo, War by Other Means, an Insider's Account of the War on Terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.